The yellow flag has been shown. The red flag is being taken away. The lights will go to red. For the last time this season, the lights change.
Away they go. Good start from Danny Pedrosa. When have we never said that?
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 311 for the week of whatever this week is in March 2012. My name is Jim Race. I am here in Northern California, down under on a rather dodgy cell phone connection, but I really don't care, is Phil Hall, the gentleman that brought us some fantastic interviews from the PI circuit, who is now at Eastern Creek, in Australia with a bit of his own concoction. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Jim. Thank you for the call. And yes, I'm here at Eastern Creek for the seventh running of the annual Barry Sheen Festival of Speed for post-classic bikes, remembering the memory of the late Barry Sheen.
Yeah, and you have brought yourself, my friend, a very, very special ride, something you've been working on for what seems like ages now, but the Shadow Facts. And we will certainly have a link to that, but that is one beautiful restored motorcycle.
We had a great day yesterday. Yesterday was actually the first time that I got to see the bike fully assembled and running, because the last bit of assembly was done by a friend. Because of my physical condition, there's some things that I simply can't do. And I saw it run for the first time yesterday, and it was taken out for some demonstration laps during the luncheon break, and shared the track with Graham Crosby on an immaculate RG 500 Mark I Suzuki that used to belong to Jeremy Burgess, who is Valentino Rossi's head mechanic, of course. My bike actually shared the track with an RG 500 Suzuki with Graham Crosby in the saddle, so it was a very thrilling day.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of people that don't know that Jerry Burgess raced an RG 500 and relatively successfully back in the day. They always just kind of think of him as this gray-haired crew chief.
Oh no, he was quite a charger actually. Yes, yeah. I've actually got some photos that I took of him back in 76, 77 on the RG. And he got around pretty well, actually.
Yep. So we've got a whole bevy for you folks out there in Motopod land of interviews. We've got Kenny Noyes. We have Scott Redding in an interview that I sort of cheated from him last night. And it's funny because I unfortunately miscalled him this morning, which was funnier even. We've got a long interview with David Emmett, and probably one of the best ones that I've done with him in a long time, from Jerez at the MotoGP test. And then an interview that you got for us with Graham Crosby, which I think is fantastic.
Yes, Crosby is such a lovely guy. I mean, I don't know when they make Graham Crosby up, but they let the ego out because he's just such a wonderful, approachable guy. People are just walking up to him in the pits and saying, "Hi, Graham, how are you? Can you sign my book?" And he's just a laid-back, gentle sort of a guy. He's still got that twinkle in his eye. He's not quite the larrikin he used to be, but he's just a fabulous guy.
Yep. Before I go any further, I do want to mention we've had some fabulous folks that have sent in donations in the last week, and I do want to run down the list of names here. Leon McDonald, Richard Jackman, Tabas Sedaris, Andrew Mantle, Benjamin Himes, Paul Olson, Rick Woods, Ian Taylor, Jacob Rauer, John Thamlitz. The fact that you guys actually send some, you know, a few funds into us, and some of you have sent substantial ones, thank you so much. That I cannot tell you how much that helps, and anybody that would like to do that in the future, please do so. That will make sure that we get to the races. That will make sure that I can get people like Phil to Phillip Island for MotoGP, as well as us making the rounds to bring you the best live coverage or semi-live coverage. I think, Phil, I think we should probably – why don't we lead off with the Graham Crosby interview?
Okay. Now, I just need to apologize, and I did this to you off microphone, but I just need to apologize that the interview appears to finish rather abruptly, and that did so because the battery in my voice recorder ran out, but there's still 15 minutes of content there of the great man talking, so it's probably worthwhile listening to for sure.
Absolutely. So let's roll into that, and then we'll come back and chat about some other stuff, mate.
Okay, well, I'm here at Eastern Creek Raceway in Sydney for the seventh running of the Barry Sheen Formula of Speed, which is the second biggest race meeting for post classic bikes after the Island Classic. And here at Eastern Creek, I'm a great pleasure to talk to former superbike rider and former Suzuki Grand Prix rider Graham Crosby. Graham, welcome back to Eastern Creek. I know that you like to come over here every year for the Sheen, and you've got a fairly special machine here on duty this weekend.
Well, that's true. You know, basically what's happened with me is that I've been out of motorcycle racing for a very long time, you know, since probably back in the early 80s when I retired from Grand Prix racing. And I kind of bought a retail motorcycle shop, which is probably not the best thing you can do if you want to maintain some sort of sanity. So it took me about 12 years to get out of that. And obviously at the end of that, I also had a passion for aircraft, so I became a commercial pilot. Finished up with that and sold some cars for Mercedes-Benz for a period of time. And I'd sort of divorced myself from motorcycles, really, because of the passion that I had with aircraft. And I'm sort of reacquainting myself now with trips down memory lane and sort of having visitation rights to some of these old race bikes that I remember so fondly. But, you know, life has moved on as far as the bikes go because, you know, they're a totally different type of thing at the moment with electronics and even traction control as we know them today. But my, I guess, passion still is back in the 70s and 80s where, you know, you could actually fix something on the side of the road or in a pit area with a screwdriver and a pair of pliers. So that's really what I've done is now re-looking at that. And part of my business currently is to do restoration work on early Japanese bikes, whether, you know, probably from a favourite point of view is the early model Kawasaki's, the Z1s, the H1s, the H2s. That sort of lineage very early sort of 70s, I suppose. Then,
which is where you started.
Well, yeah, exactly, and I don't have a problem with that. You know, you go full circle. So I'm back doing that. But being over here at the Eastern Creek event is good for me. But one of my customers wanted to buy an RG500, so I went out and found one that belonged to a local guy here in Australia, and its lineages go back to Jeremy Burgess, who of course is running a young Rossi in MotoGP at the moment. So the bike actually did belong to him for a while, and Mick Hone, another well-known Suzuki dealer here in Australia. So we picked it up and went through the spares kit and found enough bits and pieces to put it back together again. And I've got to say, the thing is really, really nice to ride around here. I'm not racing, I'm just going to do a couple of parade laps, but to reacquaint yourself with a 1976 RG500, one of the first Mark 1s, they did a pretty good job back in those days.
They were a pure racing bike, weren't they?
Yeah, they were, you know, right down to the fact that the engine configuration being a, you know, square four, two-stroke with rotary valves, and four separate crankshafts as well. So it's technically and engineering-wise, it was a delightful thing to put together. Lots and lots of rotating parts, but generally, you know, the laps that I've done around here today on something that we've built up has been quite delightful. Actually, it's really nice.
Somebody asked me when I was sitting down in the pits area, are these a high maintenance thing? And I said to them, I think if I can recall, they were fairly high maintenance.
Luckily when I was racing the RGs for the Suzuki factory, we had mechanics running around doing all this sort of stuff. So we had a few little issues, but nothing sort of terminal. They were all pretty damn reliable, actually. But the early Mark 1s and Mark 2s, they had some of the little idiosyncrasies you get with that type of bike. But again, it's one of those things that you've got to continuously, you know, put parts into, otherwise they will fail. So it's programmed maintenance, and that generally, you know, leaves you in fairly good, reliable state.
Graham, racing in America, of course, you did do some racing in America against some of the American greats, and our constituency, who are a lot of them who are Americans, will probably be delighted to be hearing your voice, remembering your Daytona exploits with Wes Cooley and Reg Pridmore and those guys.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. You know, for a very, very long time, I'd wanted to race at Daytona, and Pop Shoshimura at the time, I knew of him through through the Morawaki connection. And Pops had tried a couple of years to try and get me to go there, but it's that AMA sort of mentality where they said, well, you know, you have to have a AMA license. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I've got an FIM license and an Australian license, but they don't want to know that. They had to be an AMA license. Oh, well, I'll get a temporary one. That's easy. I'll just get one of those. Oh, no, you can't do that. Once you have an AMA license, you can't take up an FIM license. It was ludicrous. Anyway, three times we tried, and then finally, I think, much to the discontent, I suppose, of the AMA, they decided to allow it to become an international event. And, of course, I went over there and won it straight up. So maybe they were ruining the day of opening it up to foreigners. I don't know.
And what was it like? What's it like racing at Daytona? They reckon the banking is fearsome.
Yeah, 33 degrees is a fair amount. Where I guess it's the what you're used to. And when you turn up at Daytona to see that circuit, it's pretty awe-inspiring. Well, for me, most of my racing is on street circuits, so I was looking for railway lines and, you know, lampposts and things like that. There was none of that, luckily, but the banking itself was quite a novel thing for me because, you know, the guys that had raced there before all very, very quickly told me the best thing to do is, you know, you try and get up close to the wall as possible. And I even tried to walk up the wall and I couldn't. I had to actually turn around backwards where my ankles would actually bend enough to be able to walk up. So that gives you a bit of an impression of or an indication of the steepness of it. But when you're riding a motorcycle there, the other thing that does kind of make it difficult for me, because I'd never experienced it, is in the banking you're effectively riding in a cylindrical style, so while you're trying to look out ahead of you, you actually have to be looking up to the left because of the way the track is. So I found that extremely difficult, particularly when the suspension was completely bottomed out. So that was different, but luckily, you know, when I went there, the bike that I rode, the Yoshimura team had prepared three bikes, one for Dave Aldana, Wes Cooley and myself. We were the Suzuki team, and then I think Eddie Lawson was with Kawasaki, as was Greg Hansford, and I think may have even been Morawaki team with Wayne Gardner in there as well. So there was quite a few teams and lots of experience, but the bike that I had was just a missile. And I just got out there and enjoyed it. You know, I couldn't believe that the thing, A, had so much power, and secondly, it steered so well. So hats off to Wes Cooley for giving us a bike that I didn't have to really cock around too much to try and get, to some sort of racing sort of situation, I suppose. It was just easy.
Graham, I've got to ask you, because I read your book and loved the book, you know. If you haven't read Graham Crosby's book, for God's sake, go out and buy it, you know, because it is just the best read, you know. Reading it sounds just like listening to you talk. It's so realistic, you know, and I guess that's not having a ghostwriter, just writing it yourself.
Yeah, well, I wrote the whole thing. In fact, it's just come out on Kindle, so it's available in an e-book now, so you can go on Amazon, and it's a lot cheaper too, by the way.
Sure, yeah, but you don't get it signed by you, like mine is.
No, that's true, but you can always contact me through my website, and if you want a real hard copy, then I can certainly find one for you.
Well, I was enthralled. Graham, I've got to ask you about racing in Canberra. Do you remember the street circuit in Canberra where we closed off the public streets in Canberra and raced around MacArthur Park?
Yeah, it was kind of one of those situations where Oran Park in Sydney and Amaru Park in Sydney were dragging all the riders there, and somebody down in Canberra, which, you know, to those people in America, it is the capital of Australia. However, it's a sort of sleepy little town in the middle of nowhere where nothing actually happens.
Correct.
So to have a motorcycle race around the streets of Canberra was quite innovative. And I was going to run a superbike down there, but unfortunately it wasn't ready. We were getting it ready for the Boulder 24-hour race, if I recall correctly. And somebody said, well, come down, we'll find you a bike. And they pulled a bike out of the showroom floor. I think it had...
It was actually Johnny Fitzgerald's bike from Canberra Motorcycle Centre. He's the head mechanic there, and he still is.
Is that right?
And that was his own personal road bike.
Oh, okay. Well, most pictures you see of that, it's vertical on its back wheel.
That's right, with the number plate still under the front mudguard.
Yeah, that's right. That's dead right. Yeah, yeah. But that's the sort of thing you could do in those days, you know. I don't think you can do it now, of course, but racing is... It's very, very similar in New Zealand to that style, where they just shut off the middle of the streets of a city and have a road race. And you get 15, 20,000 people turn up, and these crazy people riding around on motorbikes. You know, it's completely different than what you think Grand Prix racing's all about, that's for sure.
Graham, I think most of us remember you for popping wheel stands down the S's at Bathurst on the Ross Hannon bike, which is another picture that's been immortalised in your career.
Yeah.
And your famous quotation, which way does the track go and what's the lap record?
Yeah.
And I guess personally, the other thing that I always remember is you chucking the Captain Snack bike into the wall at Oran Park, trying to go around the outside and win the 500 A grade.
Yeah, well, you've touched on three things there. That obviously the Yoshimura Superbike, which we used, was effectively just a Z1R with a very worked over engine. But basically, it was fairly standard. And the unfortunate thing is at Bathurst is the type of corner. It's a bit like what they have at Laguna Seca. I've never been there, but I can sort of picture it, trying to change directions while going over a bump at the same time.
And
the road disappears. So it's actually much easier just to put it on the back wheel. You know, then you don't have the front wheel and the back wheel sort of fighting each other. That's what I found anyway. And as far as the little 350 crash that I had at Oran Park, which is probably a bit of an infamous one as well, was I'd never ridden one of those bikes before, and we turned up at Oran Park, and I think I got the lap record in the preceding race, and then I thought, well, I'll have a go at these 500s as well, because they're old RG 500s, you know, they're cumbersome things they are, and I was on this little TZ 350. Well, the faster I went, the lap records fell and kept going. But there's got to be a point at which you can't go any faster, and I found it.
Yes.
So I had a big handful of throttle coming out onto the last corner, and the thing let go and spat me off, and I hit the wall. But, you know, the actual crash is irrelevant to me. I think what stood out for me is...
What
happened afterwards. I stood up, and, you know, being an idiot, I sort of gave everybody a nice bow, and... Somebody said, well, you know, do you want a beer or something? So somebody threw me a beer can. And I'd got back to the pit area with that beer. I didn't drink it, of course. And then I had one more race, which I ran on my superbike. And I won that race. And when I came round, they put me in the back of this vehicle. And you went past the crowd. It was the last race of the day. And everybody came across the fence and started giving me beer cans. Well, I had this utility... the tray of this truck full of beer cans. I couldn't believe it. I was there till bloody midnight, and I couldn't drink through the whole lot of them. Man, I gave it a good try, though. That showed you the popularity of what that type of racing was, and that sort of Australasian sort of the way in which they encompassed the racing. It was just brilliant.
Graham, of course, you're probably most famous for the fact that you walked away from Grand Prix racing at the peak of your career, simply because it had stopped being fun. And I think that probably, you know, those of us who saw all that happen probably had more respect for you for doing that than for soldiering on doing something that you really weren't enjoying doing anymore.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, you know, I'd arrived in the UK in 79 aboard a Moriwaki superbike and introduced superbike racing, I suppose, to the English crowd, and they got in behind it. As a consequence of that first year, I ended up with a factory Suzuki contract to run an RG 500 in the Grand Prix, which is now MotoGP, and also quite a lot of other different styles of racing, whether it be the 8-hour endurance race in Japan or Daytona on a superbike. So I had a really good two years with Suzuki. But that whole process for me became soured at the end of 1981 when Suzuki didn't contract me again through some other little problems they had, through some other political things. And I thought, well, hang on, politics, you know, I may have been a bit naive or something, I don't know, but anyway, I had a sort of a watershed there for a while and decided that, you know, I still want to go Grand Prix racing, so I turned down an offer with Honda to go superbike racing in the States, which I regret to this day, by the way, just the way I handled it. But at the end of the season, the silly season they call it, you know, it was, you know, there's more, there's always more asses than there are
seats.
Yeah. So, you know, I took a couple of, you know, like chances, I suppose, which backfired a little bit. However, Yamaha contacted me through Agostini's team and asked me if I would ride their 500 for them in 82, and that was an OW60, which is the square four version of the Suzuki RG500. And I went to Japan, tested it, and that was when it dawned on me that I'd just made the biggest cock-up in the world, because the bike I'd just come off the Suzuki was a brilliant bike. And luckily, before I'd left Suzuki, I'd taken all of the dimensions from the chassis that I could measure, and we basically installed all of those measurements onto the OW60, which transformed the bike back to probably just a fraction better than the RG500 of the year before. So I was on a winner as far as that goes, but unfortunately the...
Well, this is Philip Hall at Eastern Creek Raceway in Sydney for the 7th annual Barry Sheen Festival of Speed, commemorating the memory of the great dual world champion Barry Sheen. And it's been a great privilege to be here, and it's also been a real thrill to be able to spend some time with former World Formula One champion Graham Crosby. And I had the chance to sit down with the Cros and talk to him about some stuff, and here's what he had to say.
Cool. You know, there's a lot of folks that, and it almost makes me feel old, and I'm sure it makes you feel the same way, that there's probably a lot of our listeners that don't know that Eastern Creek is a former MotoGP circuit.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, MotoGP was run here for several years in the early 90s before it reverted back to Phillip Island. That's correct.
Yep. Right now, we've got the official MotoGP test going on. We had Moto2 and Moto3 running. There was some very interesting happenings there. There's a lot of people that are kind of behind the eight ball as far as getting bikes set up there, specifically in Moto2 and Moto3, because it took a lot of time for them to get their engines. We do have an interview with Scott Redding. I'm not sure how much you've been following that, but some of the times were pretty interesting. Thomas Luthi pretty much was running quickest the whole time. Maverick Vinales was running quick. It was nice to see Mark Marquez back out again, and his vision is good. But why don't we go ahead, and since we have to do this quick and your connection is not the best, let's go ahead and run the Scott Redding interview right now. Jim Reyes here for Motopod with Scott Redding. Dude, you have just got back from Jerez, and you kicked ass.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Again, this time out in Jerez, I think it was 7th or 8th overall. But we had a couple of gearbox problems with it jumping out of 4th and 5th and some false neutrals.
What was the deal with that? Because your teammate did not have the same issues.
No, we had all the new engines. So maybe there was just something wrong inside the gearbox there. But we got a new engine for the first GP at Qatar, so we've got that all under control, and we're ready to get out there and hit the track.
But you were still running pretty damn competitive lap times.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. We was just finding a bit hard with the hotter weather with the grip. But you know, we were still running with the top guys there. You know, Courtney and Lutie were definitely fast. But yeah, you know, we're still running well, and everything seemed to be going good.
If you look back on the testing that you guys have had, and we've had a much more unlimited amount of testing this year, the weather has been shit all the way through for one reason or another, and it's not been conducive to getting in quality testing.
Yeah, you know, we've had a couple of good days testing with the weather and stuff. It's been a bit cold. The last test we done, it was hot, so you know, we could actually get a feeling for a hot track. because it, you know, starts to move a bit more. We got to check out a few things and got a bit of a better feeling with the hot weather. Everything's working.
What are your feelings for Qatar? Because that's some place that you've not always come to grips with.
I like Qatar, you know. I'll be going out there, take a bit of a different approach. Just find a couple of little places on the track where I can make time and not worry so much about the lap time in first practice. So just look for the little things is what I want to do and put them all together for the weekend.
Eugene told me something, Laverty, your bro, something that was rather unique about that track, especially under the lights, was that you could use the lights to see the white lines on the edge of the tarmac, which is something you can't always do in the daytime.
Yeah, you know, every track's different, and, you know, with the lighting, you think it'd be pretty bad, but actually it's pretty good. It's, you know, it's like daytime there, and, you know, the lines shine off the bright lights, so you can get a bit more of a fine edge to where you're going and what you're doing.
Yeah. How's your fitness, man?
Everything's pretty good, you know. I've been training still every other day with the trainer, and, you know, went out on the bike yesterday for the first time in like 2 months in the good weather we got at the moment in England. And I had fun. It was good.
Yep. And the support that you're getting, obviously, from Mark VDS is top-notch, right?
Yeah, you know, the team's great, and they're putting everything together for me well, and I couldn't thank the boys there no more. And, you know, we want to try and get some good results this year, and everyone's knuckling down and doing the best of their ability to do what we can do.
Cool. If you had to sum up your preseason testing to this point, how would you do it? I mean, going from the very beginning to now.
Yeah, since the day we got the Calyx, it's just been a complete turnaround. You know, I feel so much happier on the bike and my feeling with it. So it's just so much better for as a rider's point of view for stuff like that. You know. It's just been amazing. You know, we've been running at the front, and, you know, we've been at the top with the front guys, so that's also good for us.
So the Calyx, do you really feel that the Calyx has turned you around?
Yeah, for me, I think the Calyx works really well for the size of me and with the bike, and, you know, just everything's transferring the weight a bit better, and, you know, I've just been happy with it from day one.
Is it one of those bikes that you can actually, from a rider's standpoint, understand and tune it to yourself?
Yeah, you know, you can do that with all the bikes, you know, but with the Calyx, you sort of get a set in, then you just play with real little fine things through it, you know, not making big changes every day. You're just trying little things. It works well, but you're always trying to find better, so you're just doing little things to find it.
Yeah. I always noticed last year that with the FTR that you spent a fair amount of time backing the thing in. The Calyx, you seem to be heading into corners from the videos that I've seen, and you're very, very in line.
Yeah, it's better. Sometimes it's nice to get the bike backing in to help turn into the corner, which we can still do with the Calyx. And last year I was just struggling on the front all the time, so it was more difficult to get it to turn when it was sideways. Now with the bike's really good.
What do you think of the front rear balance on it?
Sorry?
What do you think of the front rear balance on it? Is the Calyx a bit better?
Yeah, it's definitely good. You know, Pete's done a good job, my T-technician, to get the baby planned out for me. And, you know, we've had it all working really well, and instead of getting the weight transfer very well and working well.
I keep forgetting you've got Pete Benson as your dude. I mean, which to anybody that understands what's going on in the Moto 2 chat, you know, paddock, you've got the guru.
Yeah, you know, Pete's been great. He's been there with me since my first year Moto 2, so we're connecting really well, and we've got a good relationship with each other. So, you know, I've just got to put the things into his hands. I've got to feed him all the information I can, and he's just got to do his job and do what he can do with it.
Obviously, there's a clear line of communication, and you guys seem to be able to do that.
Yeah, you know, he's from New Zealand, so the language and the problem. And yeah, you know, we get on really well, and what's white's white and what's black's black, you know, there's no going around the question and answers. It's just straight to the point.
Cool. So what are your plans between now and Qatar?
To do the event today. I got a mini motor race to do tomorrow. Spend some time with a girlfriend and get training and getting everything prepared for Qatar, and then head out there the following Tuesday and see what we can do.
Cool. I heard you. You kind of won the Nifty 50, you bastard, and I was betting on you.
Yeah, you know, Nifty 50 race in Ireland again was pretty sweet. We had some fresh rubber on instead of the stuff that the bike came with in like 1950 or wherever it was built.
Yeah, but you had a bit of extra kit on that thing, man. You can't fool me.
Yeah, the bike was standard. There's a couple of videos on YouTube, and there's one of me where the guy comes past, I come past the guy out of the corner. He comes back alongside me, goes past me, and he tips it in. And you just hear this bike flat out, and he's shutting off. And it's me coming back around the outside, just full pin. So yeah, it was a good race.
And that was a great race. Who was the charity for?
Sorry?
Who was the charity for?
I'm not sure who the charity was for, because it was to do with something in Ireland and someone else, and the name was really long, so I find it hard to remember what it was. But it was a good charity, and you know, I was up for doing it.
But, I mean, a big part of that, you know, it's funny amongst racers, because you don't want to lose at anything. And there are some very quality racers that go out and do that. And it's a cool endurance race in a way. But there's some pride in winning that.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely competitive. The year before it was a lot closer. This year we won by four laps. But yeah, you know, you don't want anything to happen. You want to win, and you want to get it all right.
Does it make it a certain point where you're like, okay, now I want to run World Endurance Championship?
Right.
Yeah, now I want to win World Endurance Championship.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's a fun race, but competitive, and you know, as a rider, always wants to do the best of what he can do.
Yep. All right, I'll let you go. Cheers, mate. I know that you've got stuff going on, and I appreciate you taking a very short period of time with us. You have yourself an evening, and we will talk to you soon.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much.
All right, cheers, mate.
See you later.
All right, so very, very cool to have Scott on. I kind of surprised him, and I surprised myself by calling him one of those very late-night calls for me, but early-ish in the morning. None of those boys are early morning guys after they're done testing, but it was very, very cool to get him in. I also had the opportunity to talk with David Emmett of Moto Matters, and I've talked to him in the past, and it was kind of a jokey little bit in that. And I know that you're a fan of the Moto Matters website, as frankly, David has kind of exploded onto the scene as alternative media. But the man has a very good penchant for writing. I mean, you're a fan, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Have been for ages. Yeah. If he says something, then it's worth listening to, for sure.
Yeah. And has turned himself in from a software engineer into a very respectable moto journalist in the space of a very short period of time. And to be honest, it's something I would like to aspire to myself, but I can't write. I can just talk. So.
that's fair. David. More than anybody else seems to have his finger on the pulse of what's going on. The thing that I like about David most is that he lifts the sheet and peers behind the media hype and actually tells you what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I've had some email conversations with him, because he and I are we're close to equally connected with the people that we talk to, and I always say there's an awful lot that you can talk about and an awful lot that you can't. And so the conversations that we have that are outside of the bounds are sometimes even more interesting. So let's roll into that. This is going to be a long one, folks, but it is well worth it. Stick with it. So let's go ahead and roll into the interview with David Emmett.
Well, I am here at Jerez. It's still, it's Saturday morning here. It's getting on for noon. And the weather, well, the weather has called a halt to play for the moment because it's really, really windy. It's spotting with rain. It's not properly raining, so you could go out on wet tires and actually learn something.
Let me pause you there. Let's be fair. I mean, GP0 has traditionally been held in the shittiest of weather because guys go out and they do wet weather testing.
But the trouble is it's neither one thing nor another. Like I say, it's spotting with rain. If it was actually raining,
right,
then you could actually learn something. But it's dry. It's spotting with rain, so you can only go out with slicks. And it's sort of greasy enough that if you do go out with slicks, then what's going to happen is you're just going to high side yourself to a completely different planet.
When you're talking to teams or managers this morning, if you had the chance to do so.
Yeah, I caught with Wilco Zeilenberg this morning, Lorenzo's team manager, and he just sort of shook his head and said, you know, there's nothing we can do here. It might be okay for the CRT teams because they still have an awful lot of work to do on electronics, and it doesn't matter so much what the track conditions are. But he said we need to be able to push to, you know, 100% to test the stuff that we have to test and to learn what we need to learn, and you just can't do it in these conditions.
But very specifically, what were track conditions like yesterday? I mean,
yesterday it was pretty good. Again, there was a strong wind, so it was a little bit tricky in places, especially around turn sort of 9-10, which is the little loop.
Yep.
Before all the fast right-handers. That's sort of one of the highest points of the track, and it's right where the wind is blowing across hardest. It was not track records conditions. It was not ideal, but it was sunny. It was dry. Temperatures were good, and nobody complained about the state of the track. So it was okay, but not brilliant.
Did you hear anybody what the actual track temperatures were yesterday? You talked to the
no, I didn't ask about track temperatures, but it was. I mean, nobody was complaining, so the track temperatures were, you know, okay.
Okay. The CRT boys seem to be stepping up a notch. I'm fairly impressed, you know, with the exception of the bottom guys, but still the spread is not as bad as it was, say, at Sepang.
No, well, these are brand new motorcycles, and so the first seconds that you can gain are the easy ones.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to cut the gap from 5 to 4 seconds. It's a little bit harder to get it from 4 to 3 seconds. 3 to 2 starts to take a lot more work, and so for example, the bike that Piero was riding, the FTR Honda, that was screwed together on the last bolt went in on Thursday night, on the Thursday night before the Imola test last week. They slapped some Pirellis on Friday morning and took it out. And it's literally that new. And although they have a decent package in the Tenkata Honda engine and the Cosworth Electronics, which I believe Tenkata also use in World Supers, It just takes a lot. It takes a lot of time to get all these things sorted out.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was watching Pierrot, and he looked scrappy. I mean, the bike actually looked pretty good, but he looked a little bit scrappy. He was still finding his way around the track. He was still finding his way. He was clearly having trouble with figuring out braking points and figuring out the tires and all the rest of it. This was his first test on Bridgestone tires. So, it's these bikes are so incredibly new. I mean, even the suitor of Edwards, it's had so many revisions, and they started from absolutely zero with the electronics a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, but you'll remember that when I first talked to Colin about 2 months ago, he said that they were at 63%, and then he said that he was at 83%. Now he says he's at 93% to 95%.
Yeah.
But then I look at somebody like James Ellison, who is like basically stepping into the fray with, you know, not shit under his belt, and that's somebody that you have to worry about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah. But I mean, again, Ellison, he had. There was the Aragon test. Well, yeah. I think the Aragon test was going to be his first proper test on the bike.
Right.
He got a few laps at Jerez previously. I think he got about a day, maybe a day and a half. And so he's, you know, all of these teams, they have so little testing time, with the exception of Aspar. And the other thing is, Aspar is a very professional organisation. They have everything sorted and all the rest of it. So they got themselves ready. They know what they're doing. They've been helping to develop the Aprilia, and so they're in a pretty good shape. And they've got Randy Depunier, and Randy Depunier is hungry again, which is good news for everyone.
Okay, so this is why I have to ask you the question. And you know the question I'm going to ask.
I can guess. But ask it anyway.
At what point do you think that some factory squad, and which is in my mind and perhaps yours, a bit of a fucking squeaker, is... Who's going to say, who's going to cry foul, I guess is the word.
Well, everyone is whinging. Everyone is moaning. There's lots of mutterings about, well, of course, it's a factory bike and blah, 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 blah. But the Japanese factories certainly won't claim an engine, because it would be a humiliation. The only people who might do it would be Ducati.
Yeah.
But that would be more of a political statement, and would have more to do with the balance of power between Ducati and Aprilia in both in World Superbikes and in MotoGP. Excuse me. So I'm not convinced that anyone will claim an engine. And they can try. I mean, if the factories don't like it, they can try and get the Aprilia reclassified. That requires a simple majority in the Grand Prix Commission.
But you and I both know that there is no such thing anymore as a simple majority.
Well, there is. The simple authority is always going to is always going to go against the factories.
Right.
I mean, there's no way that I mean, this is the way that Dorna sees saving the series, quite rightly so, because we've got 9 extra bikes on the grid.
Yeah. And what would that mean for the rest of the Aprilia engine bikes on the grid? I mean,
nothing at all. Because the thing is, what you reclassify is the team. I mean, there is no such thing as a CRT bike. This is the whole point about it. The CRT bikes don't exist. They are claiming rule teams, and the team enters under particular conditions. And the bike that they are using has certain special allowances which are made for it.
Is De Pugnet's bike the only factory supported Aprilia team?
No. They're all. I mean, they are all to a greater or lesser extent. Getting help and backing from Aprilia. I mean, Aspar has such incredibly close ties to Aprilia that they are clearly getting more support. But as I understand it, they will own those bikes at the end of the year.
Yeah. Well, at the end of this year or the end of next year. Don't. Are you dying on me over there?
No. I've had a cough for about the last 9 months. So okay. I apologize in advance.
9 months, dude. Check yourself in somewhere. Okay. Don't you find, at least to me, Aspar one of the most fascinating squads this year?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, definitely. For a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah. I mean, just across the entire spectrum, and there's several teams this year that are doing the exact same thing. Grassini is another one.
Yeah. Well, this is the whole point. All of a sudden, with Moto3, Moto3, Moto2, and CRT, it allows you to run a full squad again. I mean, it becomes affordable. The team's still very heavily subsidized by Dorna.
Put air quotes around affordable, would you please?
yeah, exactly. Yes, affordable. This is in both P terms, which is cloud cuckoo land, but never mind. So it becomes affordable to run to run three teams, or it does for teams which are good at finding sponsors.
Yeah, well, you and I have been playing at this game, and probably in the same vein. And we're you and I are both new media. You're farther along than I am, of course. But it's you have to admit from our perspective, and we come and you and I both come from a very cynical perspective.
Yeah,
that it's fun to watch, but it's nice to have a cynical perspective going into it.
Oh yeah, I mean you have to be realistic about about everything, really. There are still massive problems with the series, and the biggest problem, it's not the amount of money we're spending, but the appalling lack of the lack of ability to raise sponsorship is still a huge problem, and there's lots of reasons for that, and Dorna is one of the problems. Dorna helps. Dorna manages to shoot itself in the foot too often.
Well, that being said, that they have not shot you and I in the foot. In fact, I heard through the grapevine that you are now profitable.
Yes. Well, yeah, but that's the point. I mean, you have to learn to make money. I mean, it's been really hard because the motorcycle industry is to call them conservative is a it would be an insult to conservatives. They are a really, really. They're stuck in the 1950s. They're still trying to come to grips with television, and so the internet is something completely mysterious. And every time I talk to potential advertisers, with a very, very few exceptions, they all say the same thing. Yeah, we really need to start switching to online. We need to advertise online, but we don't know how to do it. We don't know. We're not sure exactly what how to go about it.
Trust me, I am in the same boat because I'm trying to figure out how to do the same thing for this show, which pulls in as many people as you do.
Yeah.
And man cannot survive on random donations alone.
No, exactly. No, it's all about It's all about diversifying your revenue streams.
Sure.
And to an extent, I had a conversation with Lynn Jarvis on the after the Yamaha presentation, and he said very much the same. He said, you know, we have to find sponsorship, we have to find new revenue streams, we have to explore new types of media, we have to, you know, open up and try and find ways of bringing more money into the sport, and that's what I've had to do with the website. You just have to imagine your way into to generating income, and it's very, very hard. What amazes me is that large media corporations fail so dismally at it, because they have armies of ad sales people who should be going out and hammering potential advertisers into submission, but they seem incapable of it.
But, I mean, that being said, what it has allowed people like you and I to do is get in places that if you can't even imagine, say, 5 years ago, that we would even have had the opportunity to talk to people that we have the opportunity to talk to now.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, basically, the only reason I managed to get the website running and keep it running is because the major news organizations have failed so dismally, because they've given me the opportunity. They've opened a gaping hole for me to drive my little truck into.
Well, your little truck is no longer, dude, you're driving a big fucking lorry.
Well, it's a little bit too early to say for that. Obviously, in 5 years' time, I will have taken over the world, but one step at a time.
Yeah, you and I have very different takes on what we do. You do your job with words. I do my with type. I do my job with words, and we both have our very cool niches.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. It's about creating niches and stuff. And you see lots and lots of websites sort of starting up and then stopping again because they. But they're all trying to do the same thing, and it's about creating an identity. It's about selling a brand.
Well,
Valentino Rossi has done so successfully in the years that he's been racing.
I think part of it is that we're on top, and we're pretty hard to unseat.
Yeah. Well. I'm not sure. I'm always I wake up this morning.
A little wary. Just in case somebody comes along and goes, oh, God damn.
I expect to get found out. I mean, every time I come to a race, I expect to, at some point, someone to come up to me, take my pass away, and ask me what the fuck I'm doing here.
All right. So tell me what you expect out of today. You said that it's pissing down rain, so you.
Well, if it was pissing down, there would actually be some use to it, but it's not. It's just spotting with rain, but it's very, very windy. Very.
Okay. Give me an idea on the temperatures there.
It's not too bad. It's 18, 19 degrees, which is mid 60s, something like that. You're in American money.
Yeah.
So I mean, if it wasn't so windy, and like yesterday, we had some pretty pleasant temperatures because the sun is nice and strong. When the sun is out and the wind drops, the temperatures rise. But it's the wind which is the real problem here.
Okay.
At the moment, it doesn't look like there's going to be much going on today. But the weather forecast for Sunday is looking much, much better.
Okay, so you do know that during a test that Dorna very much relaxes their restrictions on, even though I am kind of unrestricted, much to many people's chagrin, on getting interviews in the paddock. But
yeah,
that means that perhaps you, my friend, can go out and get an interview for me or two.
That would be... I have a piece of paper which tells me exactly what I can't do, and giving people audio is very much there. So I'm as much as I would love to.
Damn, David.
Yeah.
No. They never give me one of those papers.
Yeah, well, yeah, this is it. They give me one of those pieces of paper. They make me pay money to sign this piece of paper, which says that if I put any audio or video online, I can hand back my pass, and I won't get my money back.
How do they come to love me and not love you, David?
Because you've always had video audio and stuff. I think that's the difference.
True. I've actually gotten hate mail from journos going, you can't do this. I'm like, well, I'm sorry, I didn't. They don't get mad about it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
What are your expectations for today? So we're looking at. You said the wind is coming up, which means the track is going to dry out. Probably bikes out on track in, say, an hour and a half.
I doubt it.
Really?
I doubt it. I think. Hang on, what's the time now? 11:45. Maybe by 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, they might get a couple of hours in at the end of the day if it clears up. But although it's sort of brightening up a little bit, but again, the wind, it's a really strong wind, which makes riding really difficult.
Yeah.
We might see some CRT bikes go out there, but we're not going to see much. We're not going to see the factory bikes do much today.
Have you been down into the back paddock, or are there guys giving interviews and just kind of chit chats about what their thoughts are? Yeah, I know there's been a bunch of team presentations prior to this, but are there any talks going on this day?
I think that there's a lot of meetings going on from what I can gather on Twitter. Ben Spees and Colin Edwards are just sitting in their motorhomes watching DVDs.
Yeah.
Randy Depunier is wandering around the media center. He's just gone out. I think Rossi is in meetings with his team for the obvious reasons. Yeah.
you have no idea what you're going to do for the morning, do you?
Oh, no, I have a bunch of stuff to do. I have loads of stuff to do. I've got the talk I did with Lynn Jarvis that he's typing up and turning out, because that's very interesting. It's going to be about the future of the series after 2013. After okay. this year, so no, there's plenty, and there's people I need to see, other people I need to talk about this with. So no, plenty of stuff to do.
Okay, talk to me a bit, because I know this is something that's near to dear to your heart, and this is something that you know that I've addressed on shows in the past. Sponsorship. And the suckage of it. It's been brutal. Kenny Noyes is somebody that you've worked with in the past.
Yeah.
And I know that I sent you an interview that our listeners are going to hear on this show. And you got the raw version. Mm. It's a clusterfuck, isn't it?
It's just incredibly hard. And I mean, again, to an extent, this is also there are lots of different sides to this. For a start, the teams, because of the tobacco sponsorship, back in the 80s and 90s, when motorcycle racing or motorsports in general were the only places that that tobacco had to go in terms of advertising, because they'd been banned from TV, banned from movies, banned from everywhere else. They had nowhere else to go. Teams didn't have to do anything to raise sponsorship. The tobacco companies would come in and they would ask the teams, please, can we sponsor you?
Sure.
And so the teams had nothing in place they had nothing in place to actually raise sponsorship themselves. And this is still a situation they're dealing with, despite the fact that it's been, what, 5-6 years since, no, longer, 7 or 8 years since we lost tobacco sponsorship. They're still trying to figure out how to gain sponsors, and it's only teams with strong connections, strong local connections to business communities that have managed to raise sponsorship. And what the other teams are doing is putting the onus of finding sponsors on the riders. Right. So riders are welcome to come as long as they can bring a sponsor or two with them. The days of paid rides are, unless you are of an exceptional talent, the days of paid rides are over. So,
And there was a pause from both of us there going,
yeah, exactly. To be honest, Dorna does do a lot of work to try and raise sponsorship, but they also shoot themselves in the foot because whenever teams do bring sponsors into the championship, Dorna makes sure they also get a cut of the sponsorship.
Right.
Which you saw with the Yoda CRT bike that's Petrucci is racing.
Yeah.
You see the Came, or Came, if you like, sponsorship, which is an Italian a brand of Italian doors. They were in the Superbike paddock. They're now in the MotoGP paddock. Right. But for them to sponsor Sacchi and Yoda, they also had to sponsor a Grand Prix. They also had to partner with Dorna.
Right.
Because Dorna can refuse a sponsor if they feel it's detrimental to the series.
Yeah. And that actually kind of brings me back down to, let's say, the what we consider the current bottom of the CRT grid. Mm-hmm. Ivan Silva, Ziani Hernandez, the guys that have not had a lot of time on track. And
yeah.
some of those bikes that have, you know, just basically been bolted together. Looking at the times from yesterday,
yeah.
Frankly, I'm impressed because we're not looking at, you know, the 6 to 8 second gaps that we had when we were looking at Sepang.
That's the nature of the track as well. I mean, that's a 2 minute lap, and this is a 140. This is a 140 lap. It's a slower track, so it's not so much about horsepower. The Kawasaki's, I mean, Silva, and although ironically, at the moment, top of the timesheets is Ivan Silva, because he did two laps, whereas Johnny Hernandez only did one lap.
But those
Kawasaki's, the engine was forced on them because they are the Avintia team has links to Kawasaki, to the Spanish Kawasaki importer.
That being said, those engines are powerful. And have been known to be that way, and especially if they've got the 2012 version, they will kick ass, and the electronics are actually pretty good. The question being, can they tame them for the chat? What chassis are they running those? Do you know?
It's an FTR chassis.
Okay.
It's an FTR chassis, but the problem with the Kawasaki engine is that it's very tall.
Yeah.
So that limits it limits. Your options for locating various items, and it forces the, because if you look at the bikes look tall as well. The tank is up along, is up very high. It makes it difficult to put to put the weight where you want it, exactly where you want it, without running out of space.
Okay.
Around the front wheel.
Then I guess we have to run into the obvious question, which is engine location. Rossi has been complaining, and rightly so, even though Nicky is well ahead of him.
Yeah.
Of not being able to load up the front end enough to, which essentially means that you're getting chatter going into a corner. And Dennis Noyes, or I think either him or Spallers today on Twitter, was, you know, why can't Rossi load the front, or why is he having issues? If Nicky can do it, and that's probably part of his dirt track experience, because he knows how to kind of jump over the tank. Why can't he? And why have they not got it right yet? And clearly, we're in early days, right? We haven't even got to the first race, and it's still in the middle of GP Zero.
Yeah, but right. There's a number of questions there. Nicky last night said that he also has some problems with the front end on corner entry, but he's also having problems on corner exit as well. So he is, for him, it's not so much of a priority. And the two have very different styles. And to a certain extent, I think also with the way that Stoner rode the bike was to use the rear much more, to ride around the limitations of the front end. But Valentino Rossi needs a good front end. If he doesn't have a good front end, he has no confidence and he can't go fast.
Yeah.
And the problem is the what they've done with the engine is rolled it back so that it's much more upright. It's much more like a Honda VFR, if you like, where it's the two cylinders are at 45 degrees to the vertical. But that's still the trouble with a 90 degree V, which is what it still is you have a massive empty chunk of empty space between the cylinders, which is completely wasted.
Sure.
I wrote about this in the middle of last year, that they needed to build a 72 or 75 degree V to close it up, because that makes the engine more compact and it gives them much more options in terms of, you know, moving weight around. And that's what they still haven't been able to do. They're stuck with a 90-degree V, because designing a new engine with a different angle is a much, much bigger job than just, you know, rotating the bike backwards, or rotating right. the existing angle backwards.
Did you catch the interview that Phil Hall did for me with Carlos Checa about, because, you know, they had to put an extra 6 kilos.
I didn't. I still haven't caught up with that, but I was very interested in it.
Yeah, because he actually described exactly where they put the weight on the bike. One of the most fascinating bits that I've ever heard from a rider, as far as honesty and saying, okay, this is we did this. You know, a lot of people think that, you know, it's a lump of lead that you throw somewhere. No.
Yeah, no, it isn't. No, no. Yeah. No, there's lots of different ways of doing it, and there's lots of different places you can you can put weight.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same thing that they have to do there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, but it's not just that. It's also, I mean, Rossi keeps complaining about his riding position. He wants to be closer to the he wants to be able to get closer, but he can't do that because it's a 90 degree V, mm-hmm. and the rear bank of cylinders is in the way, so that he just can't find a position where he's got more weight over his over the front. And again, it's a physical limitation of the engine layout. They need to ditch the V90, but that's a massive, massive job.
You're right. No, and even though they twisted it in the frame, and they thought that they had what they had.
Yeah.
I mean, how long before a GP 12-1?
Well, they're due to get some upgrades after three races. Whether that will include sort of modifications to the engine is debatable. It doesn't seem like it. I think they are more or less stuck with what they have. Like the engine redesign cost a massive amount of money.
Absolutely.
And so they really, really need to get it right at some point.
Okay.
And they keep on not getting it right.
I had a prediction, and I will hang on to it. At least in a wet race, we will see a CRT bike on the box.
The only person who would be good enough is Randy Depounier, and I'm not sure Randy's that good in the wet. It would be. If Mullen was still in the series and was on a CRT bike, then for sure it'd be. Absolutely no doubt. The thing is, the other riders are all. Casey's pretty good in the wet. Jorge's pretty good in the wet. I think you'll see a CRT bike in the top six. Maybe top five, and certainly in dodgy conditions. I think the podium is a little bit too far, but I think they will be a long way. They'll be much, much closer to the front.
Do you think anybody is sandbagging at this point?
No. No, I don't think so. But I think what Stoner is doing is sort of sandbagging, where he goes a little bit slow, and then all of a sudden he bangs in a single really, really ridiculously fast lap just to humiliate everyone. So I think people should be very, very afraid of what Stoner's capable of.
Right. Okay. But, so I agree with you, because if we go back to Sepang 2, Dennis Noy has penned a perfect article on this. I've seen a couple of other analyses of it, and it's very simple. You can get the stats off MotoGP.com.
Yeah.
Is that Jorge banged out a shitload of laps of full race simulation. And in fact, from my understanding, that both Ben and Jorge did the same thing today and were running laps that were extremely competitive. And Casey was going out and doing four lap stints. And my understanding is for tomorrow, that tomorrow, the Yamaha boys are going to be going out and going for less fast lap times, as well as testing a couple of different parts. But I have a feeling tomorrow is going to be a lot different.
Yeah. I mean, tomorrow is going to be much more
tomorrow being your today.
Yes. Well, tomorrow, everyone gets to do, everyone is going to be sort of flat out.
Yeah.
Today's not much is going to happen. Stoner yesterday said he did a race simulation, but it was a very short race simulation, but it was long enough for him to understand how the soft tire degrades.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the analysis yet. I need to go and have a look at it. But he seemed pretty happy.
Did you do a post-race brief with – or yeah. post – okay, yeah. And what did you glean from that?
Mostly that he was annoyed that the bike didn't chatter. They had loads of chatter at Sepang.
Yeah.
And they'd come here hoping to fix the chatter, but they're here and it doesn't chatter, and now they don't know why, and that's a bit annoying.
So the difference between Jerez and Sepang, I mean, you come into Sepang at, 320K in a turn one, as well as the final corner coming on the front straight.
Yeah, the chatter is coming. The chatter is coming in from the rear and not from the front, because of the construction of the rear tire. And as I understand it, it's not the tight corner. It's the faster corners which is giving problems.
And it's the same thing Colin said to me. I mean, he's like, yeah, the rear end is fine, but that's where the chatter is coming from. It's everybody. To a man that I've talked to has said they're pushing the front and it's too late.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stoner, apart from that, was perfectly seems pretty happy with everything and happy with his pace. When your biggest problem is that you don't have a problem that you were hoping to be able to fix, then things are generally looking okay. He was happy with the balance of the bike and all the rest of it.
We had a listener write in last night. I apologize because I forgot your name, but he was trying to ask me basically why can't Rossi load the front, and I was trying to figure out how to explain it to him because my limited racing experience, when you're trying to load the front, what you're really trying to do is put enough weight on the front so that the bike doesn't shatter. But if you can't get your weight over the front, then you'll laugh because I'm sitting here with my hands in front of the mic and I'm picturing it. And when you're trying to push your weight forward, and if you can't do it because of the geometry of the bike and the way that your legs and your feet are set up on it, if you can't get the weight forward, no matter what, the bike is going to start chattering, and there's nothing you can do to force that. And what happens is you have to back off going into a corner, and you can't carry your corner speed. Mm-hmm. And especially when you come out, the bike is going to want to stand itself up. So and he thought that it was more chatter under braking, but that's not the case.
No.
Yeah,
and the other thing is that, I mean, there are two things. There are basically two things here. I mean, that's a good explanation of what you're trying to do when you're to get more weight on the front. The thing is, the Bridgestones are incredibly stiff. They are an incredibly stiff tire. You take all the air out, and they still and the bike. You can't tell if the bike has a flat tire.
They're running like probably, and I'd be curious about this, and if you could source this out for me, and I'd be very curious. If I had to guess, even at Sepang in probably cold temperatures, they're probably running, if I had to guess, 11 front and maybe 18 rear. Cold.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. Again, it's hard to because this is now key setup data, and so teams won't tell you.
Yeah. You could ask the Bridgestone guys what they're doing them off the rigs.
Mm. Yeah. Yes. I shall look into that. I shall ask and see if I can find anything out. But you know, It one of the factors they play around with is a little bit more pressure front and, or a little bit more pressure or a little less pressure. But the whole point about the about getting weight over it is to try and load the tire, trying to heat the tire, and to you know, drive it into the track to get it heated and to get it to grip. And there's two things. First of all, a photographer called Nick Little, he spoke to Elena Rosell, the female rider who's running for the QMMF in Moto2, and she said that she finds it very difficult. She can't find the correct physical position on the bike, possibly because of anatomy, because you know women's hips are slightly different, and all the rest of it. And so she's
thank God.
Exactly. But because of that, she can't get the weight over the front. She can't get she looks bad because the bike needs to be adapted so she can actually ride it. So the shape of a tank, for example, can sort of prevent you from getting your body into the position that you want it to be. Right. And the other thing, especially about the Bridgestones, is you have to trust them. You have to have complete confidence in them. This is the one thing that Christian Gabarini said to me, that Stoner, he does not. He never trusted the electronics blindly. He trusted the Bridgestone front tire blindly. Yeah. So the way that he loaded it, he just knew it was. He assumed it was going to grip.
Yeah.
So he wasn't afraid to get in very, very late and brake very, very hard, and that would allow him to put, to generate the kind of load in the tyre that would bring it up to temperature and force it to grip. And this is something that you can't sort of work towards. And I think this is Rossi's problem. He wants to he wants to work his way towards the with the Ducati towards, you know, getting more grip in there. But it doesn't work like that. It's a digital thing. Either it grips or it doesn't grip. And the only thing you can do is go really, really fast and hope that it grips.
Yep. What are you looking at for weather over the next, besides today and tomorrow?
Well, actually, the wind seems to be dropping a little bit, so maybe I keep looking out at the flags outside, and it seems to be getting a little bit better. But today, like I said, windy. It's fairly cloudy, so there'll probably be spots of rain. Tomorrow should be fine. Should be, you know, good weather, maybe a little bit of wind.
Okay, and if you were going to pick somebody to... I don't even need to do this because Stoner's going to win GP0 like he has for years on end.
Yeah.
And get the goddamn BMW. I hate that man for that.
There's no BMW here.
Oh, really?
There hasn't been for the past few years. Again, it's cost cutting. BMW doesn't want to give the BMW away, and also this isn't being televised, which is a real shame.
I know. I sent Gavin Emmett an email last night, and I'm like, dude, please, do we have anything? And Michael Morrell as well, and I'm like, you guys are killing me. Yeah. The highlights are just no fun. Listen, I should probably let you go. We've chatted for way too long, once again, as I do. What are your plans for the rest of today?
Today, work. Catch up with some work some interviews that I did with people, and try and find out a little bit more about the state of play, the MSMA, and the rules for 2013 onwards.
Okay.
Hang around, wait and see if the bikes hit the track or not.
Yeah, doesn't it feel just a bit weird without Paul Butler there?
Yes, a little. In fact, I haven't seen them. I haven't run into Mike Webb yet. I have to go and chase up Mike Webb. Yeah. Who's taken over Paul's spot. But it's a new season. It happens every season. It's a new season, and people, all of a sudden you'll see someone in a different shirt, and you're trying to figure out how that is. I mean, Matteo from Pramac is now wearing a Yamaha shirt, and everyone's in different colours, and it's always a little bit strange, but it's always fun.
What have you seen? And because there is always something like this, what have you seen that's kind of goofy so far?
I haven't really, apart from the man in the I posted a picture of a gentleman in a very goofy hat on Twitter, which was colourful, wearing a Repsol T-shirt and a hat with horns attached. But truck horns, not Viking horns.
So what you're saying is you're not actually going to tell me what the goofiest thing that you've seen so far.
I haven't been looking for goofy things, really. I'm too excited just to be back in the paddock again to...
True. Well, perhaps I should talk to you in a night hence.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yes. In a few races time, once I've spotted some odd things.
Yeah, well, hopefully the outliers that listen to you and me in the show won't have such a harsh comment for me. and yes, I do listen, you folks out there, to when I get the opportunity to talk to you, David. And I wish you the best of luck. And maybe if we have the opportunity, we'll talk tomorrow night.
Yeah. If I can find the, if I have time, I'll be happy to make time for you.
Cool. All right. Thanks, man.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right. So huge, huge thanks to David for that. I have to commend the man. He sounded probably more calm than I've heard him in a long time. Some very frank conversation and some great insight on day one of the Harest test, what I also always call GP0. I know that you haven't had much of a chance to keep an eye on that right now because you've been traveling. Mate, how many miles have you driven or ridden in the last, let's say, 2 months to get to races? We're talking some serious territory.
Oh, yes. I live in Wollongong, which is on the south coast of New South Wales. It's over 1,000 kilometres to Phillip Island and 1,000 kilometres home. I've done that twice. And it's about 150 kilometres, about 100 miles from my place to Eastern Creek, and I've done that for the last 3 days.
What are you looking at for weather?
For
Eastern Creek for this post-classic race?
Post-classic racing is gathering strength here in Australia, mainly because of the fact that it's still a relatively cheap formula. The super bikes and super sport bikes are still very popular, of course. But post-classic racing is much more accessible for competitors, and despite the fact that post-classic racing is often seen as an old fogies formula, it's amazing how many young bikes are getting involved in the game now.
Well, and if we look back, I think probably one of the most amusing interviews that I've had, and certainly the most amusing interview of 2012, has to be the one you did with Roger Gunn.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, I've got to tell you, that was really strange because I spent 5 days with Roger and the team at the Island Classic with Ed Hazer and Jimmy Mack, and it was just a hoot from the time I walked in the door till the time that I went out again. And I went down to the pits at World Supers to get the interview with Roger Gunn because Ed had said to me, please, please, please get an interview with Roger Gunn. Find out why he wanted to invite us down to race for his team at the Island Classic. So I went down to the pits and I was very, very focused. I was determined that I was going to play it absolutely straight and not muck around and, you know, make it a proper, fitting, legitimate interview, right?
Yep.
So I walked down to the pit enclosure, and Roger was standing talking to someone, and I walked up beside him, just on his left and just behind him, and I was waiting for an opportunity to butt into the conversation, say, excuse me, Roger, can I take, you know, some time to do this interview with you? And he turned around and looked over his left shoulder and did a double take, and then he said, Jesus! And I said, no, Roger, it's Phil. And of course, that just blew the whole thing out of the water. And as soon as I sat down and started talking to him, and he talked about offering the guys beer and money and girls and so forth, I thought, well, you know, this is going to hell in a handbasket. You know, I'm just going to have to play along with this.
As an American, I can understand the Australian dry humor. Not only that, but the UK humor. But I did appreciate the fact that he eventually broke down and kind of lost his cool.
Well, I think he just realized that he probably did have to say at least one thing in the interview that was sensible.
Still, we got some incredible feedback from your interviews. There are people that are said, oh, well, you've got a new member of the team. And I think I told you even before you left, welcome to the crew. So I will reiterate that now. Welcome to the Motopod crew.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you. And, you know, for a guy at my age to be branching out into something that's rather different to what I've done in the rest of my career, I've got to tell you, I am having a ball, an absolute ball.
Well, drag yourself back to your Bathurst days. I mean, this is nothing new to you, really.
Well, no, I guess so. But I guess my background as being a teacher means that I do tend to speak clearly and distinctly, which I guess helps. But I've been hanging around motorcycle road racing since 1976.
Yeah.
And I've seen a bit in that time. And so I guess that background helps when you start asking people questions about what they're doing and where they're going and where they have to be.
Well, and after all that time and you spend that much time around paddocks, you kind of learn the etiquette and respect that you have to pay attention to, and you know when to approach and you know when to step back.
Oh, absolutely. And it was fascinating at World Supers because the World Superbike people aren't quite as precious as the MotoGP people, but there is still very clear lines of the demarcation of where you can stand and where you can't, and who you talk to and who you don't. And apart from the Carlos Checker interview, which I'm very grateful that you organised through Heather Chapman and Carlos's press office, all the rest of those interviews I simply got by standing at the door of the pits and politely asking someone if I could speak to their press officer and would it be convenient for me to interview their rider. And they were all very obliging. I didn't get any knockbacks at all.
Well, next time I need to make sure that you've got a company shirt and a boatload of stickers, don't I?
Yeah, that would be cool. That would be really cool, actually. Yes, thank you. Appreciate that. And again, yeah, let me say I feel really privileged to be part of the crew. Because I've got a huge respect for what you and Jules and Martin do. And, you know, it's just great to be able to tag along with it.
Cool. Well, let's take this opportunity to roll out the last one. This would be one Kenny Noyes, who had a Moto2 ride. It's kind of a heartfelt interview because he had something lined up. Much like Ant West, as you know, who got...
I was just going to say that. But Anthony West can identify with that.
Yeah. He basically got... Kenny got screwed out of one ride. Ant West got screwed out of two and has managed to land on a pretty good spot in BSB. Kenny Noyes has managed to land on probably one of the best teams in the CEV National Championship, that being the Spanish Racing National Racing Series. And so we had a great chat, and I think you guys are going to enjoy that. And we'll round the show out with that, and then we'll come back and close things out.
I always think it's a shame that the really talented riders don't get the ride, and less talented riders that have got money do. There's something wrong with the sport when that's happening. I don't know what it is, and I don't know what the answer is, but it annoys the hell out of me.
And you will actually hear me talk about that in the interview. All right, let's roll in.
Jim Race here for Motopod with Kenny Noyes. Kenny Noyes, and I have to say this every time, dude, son of Dennis Noyes, because he's a great rider. You are riding in the CEV National Championship this year, not the ideal place that you want to be. But that being said, it is a very challenging series.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm riding in there as of a week ago. I mean, the way it played out with the team in the World Championship left me, you know, in a tough position with not much time to react. And fortunately, I believe I'm on, you know, the best or one of the best teams in the Spanish Championship on a competitive suitor. So, I mean, I'm happy to have landed on my feet, but it's been a bad last month for me.
Yeah, I know you've been chasing a lot of stuff. You know, but, and a question I poised earlier in the show, and I'm going to sneak you into this show, is I'm pretty sure that the CEV National Championship is probably the most competitive one on the planet.
Well, I mean, you know, AMA is very competitive. I think the British Championship is also very good. I think kind of everywhere you go, you have a good championship. The thing about the CEV is that it leads directly into MotoGP because of the categories they have, you know. Right. So it's really easy for a kid starting out over here to go, you know, step by step, and it leads naturally into GP, you know. So by the type of tracks that are over here and the bikes we're racing on, it's definitely – it feeds you right into GP. But man, a lot of respect to everybody in the AMA, a lot of respect to the guys in BSB. You know, it's everywhere you go, at the top, at the front, in every, you know, one of the big championships, it's very tough.
Yeah, I think part, but in the question that I posed, and I actually asked our listeners to comment on this, was, is it because of the fact that you get to race all of the GP tracks, or is it also because of the fact that you get to get mentored as a younger rider in the CEV?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, one thing I was just telling a Spanish magazine about, you know, I'm 33 now. So
damn, you're old, dude.
Yeah, no shit. Oh, I don't know if I can say that. Can we say that?
Yeah, you can say that in here.
All right. Yeah, I know. So they were telling me that, and I was saying, you know, I started racing when I was 18 and not even very seriously. You know, I'd go to Lodi and race dirt track and it was fun until I started, you know, going fast. And then it started getting more serious because I got signed by Husaberg and with Dale Lineweaver and everything. But I started really late. And when I came to Spain, before I even started road racing, you know, I came over after in 2001, after winning the dirt track championship. And I remember at a go-kart track watching Marquez, and he already had like a team of two mechanics there.
Yeah.
He had Van, he had two little metric kit bikes, which were little two-stroke, you know, little GP bikes. And he was like, they had telemetry on the thing. I mean, it was gnarly. Yeah. And he was six or I don't know, five. I don't know how old he was. Maybe eight or I don't know. But it was like the guy – I was, what, in 2001? I don't know, but that was 24, no?
Just a kid.
Yeah, and he was, and he already had more road race experience than me, you know? So.
I know. Well, I mean, if you look at it, you know, Stoner, Pedrosa, all those guys came up through CEV. There's a ton of other racers that did. And
when I first came over here, he was getting his butt kicked. He was like fifth, sixth, couldn't hang with the guys in the Spanish championship, you know?
Yeah.
But he definitely evolved. And that's the thing. He had the team, he had the bike, and he had the tracks to build his skill.
Cool. So tell me and tell the listeners who you're racing with this year, because you've got a kick-ass ride.
Yeah, it's PL Racing is the team. They're actually sponsored by Kawasaki and Palmetto. They're the Spanish Kawasaki factory team, I guess. And they weren't even going to race Moto 2. And I started talking to them as soon as I lost the ride in GP, because I'd raced with them before in Kawasaki and really liked the way they worked.
Yep.
And also because they have George Bukmanovic as their crew chief, you know?
Yeah, you brought over a bit of your team.
No, George was already with them.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
George was with them last year with Silva in the Spanish championship. And he stayed on with the men. And the guy knows so much about racing, about setup, and it's just great to work with him. So they decided to put together a Moto 2 team also for me, and I believe I'm going to have also Argentinian teammates. So it'd be cool. We'll have a little Moto 2 structure inside the Kawasaki team.
Very cool. How much do the rules in Moto 2 at CEV differ from MotoGP?
The tires were run on Michelin in the Spanish Championship.
Okay.
And I just got back from the first test, and that's kind of the main difference. You know, the tires have a different character, got a lot more grip in the rear, and probably I don't have as good a feel with the front. It can't get the bike to turn as well. So
it's pushing in the front.
Kind of, yeah. It changes the setup, changes the character of the bike, and also the engines are stock. So the combination
like box stock CBR 600 engines.
Yeah.
So this is odd because you're running with a squad that's sponsored by Kawasaki and Honda engines.
Yeah, you're not going to find Honda anywhere on my bike. That's for sure. But no, we're in a separate box, so it's not. There's no Kawasaki anywhere, but we are in the Kawasaki truck, so it's kind of
okay. Kinda weird.
But so the engine is slower than the World Championship engine, and the tires are grippier. So it just got to get on it so soon.
So it's all about corner speed.
Yeah, all about corner speed. And at least in this first test, we had a bunch of chatter. So it's tricky. You know, we have to figure out how it works pretty quickly.
There's nothing worse than pushing the front and like you're trying to bomb a corner, and especially on the exit, and the front is pushing. And you're like, fuck.
Yeah. I mean, at least when you have horsepower and you have some chatter problems, you can always kind of work around it. But when you don't have much power and your chatter's killing your corner speed, it's tricky. Yeah. For sure.
So what are your prospects for this year? Obviously, you're with a damn good team. It's one of the top teams in the CEV. What do you see your prospects as?
I mean, we're going for the title. For sure. You know, we've got a good team, good bike. I think the experience I have in the past 2 years with the World Championship really, you know, really upped my game as far as a rider. And that's our goal. I mean, you know, and obviously, you know, you take a step back to a national championship, you find all the guys that have been there, you know, young guys coming up, you find the guys that are established, and it's never easy. But our goal is to win the championship.
Cool. Well, you always have to reach for the top. I'm sitting here watching in the background or on my other monitor the times from Daytona. You and I were chatting about that before we had a talk. The sport bikes, which is, you know, the junior class in the AMA, they're doing 180 around Daytona. I remember you've run in AMA. That's astounding on a stock 600.
Yeah, Daytona is so gnarly because you know the banking looks smooth pretty much on TV. Yep. When you get on a bike, the force, the G force and the bumps and everything, I mean that's if you're doing that speed at Daytona, it feels twice as fast than in a normal track on a straightaway just because of how close the wall is and because of the track. So it's amazing. I mean, that's fast.
I'm astounded that a super sport AMA bike can do 180 around there. That's off the hook. Crazy.
Yeah it is.
Yeah. All right. So plans, if you were going to look out a couple of years, run, win the championship in the CEV in Moto2 and head back to Moto2 in the GP ranks.
Yeah. I mean, that would be beautiful, but honest, I mean, the way it played out this year with the team I had an agreement with, you know, is pretty bad as far as how the money situation is affecting, you know, racing over there. So
honestly,
I mean, I never expected to be in the World Championship and I got 2 years there. If I get to go back, I'm really, you know, I feel like I have some unfinished business there, you know, because I started really getting it kind of figured out, got my best result on my last race. And I was really pumped for this season, you know, and to be left without a ride, especially the way it happened, you know, was tough to take. But from this point, honestly, anywhere, you know, anywhere I have a good shot at being competitive, that's where I want to be. You know, I don't want to be just go to GP just to be there and be on an underfunded team and just, you know, with no chances. You want to go for sure wherever you are with a good team, you know.
I remember talking to you in December of last year, and you were super freaking disheartened. You were like, you were hurting from your surgery, and it was a tough conversation that we had.
Yeah, I mean, it's been some just really crappy Christmases, you know.
Yeah, so somebody needs to bring you some real presents, don't they?
Yeah. And this year, I mean, this year, it was worse because what happened with Banderas is that, you know, the sponsor left. The team decided to quit the championship. They couldn't keep going, and it was really how it happened. But this year with this Bayonet team, they had an agreement with me. It was real clear in November, and we had a verbal agreement. Then they sent me, you know, the outline of a contract. Everything was cool. I actually signed it, sent it back to them, and never got it back in the mail. But it was all done, and 2 weeks before the first test, you know, they asked us for a whole bunch of money to race. So, and then they didn't quit. They've gone with another rider that brought money. So it was bad. The situation was bad last year, but it was worse this year.
Yeah, and I've seen that happen across the spectrum of racing, not only with Moto2 and World Supersport and guys getting dropped and BSB and everything else. You're like, and from my perspective, to be honest, I'm kind of pissed off about it because owners and team principals should stick to their guns when they make an offer.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes they make an offer and it's clear from the beginning. They'll tell the rider, listen, you need to come up with X amount of money and sponsorship in order to be able to ride. The rider can't come up with it, and they don't go through.
Yeah.
But when they make an agreement like this team did with me, you know, I didn't have to bring anything. I wasn't getting paid, but I had some space on the bike, and I had, you know, clothing sponsors and stuff. So it was a good deal.
Yeah.
Because, man, you know, we're racing out there, and you know, it's a job. It's probably, you know, you look at the whole team and the racer is the most important guy out there. And the problem is, you know, there are guys out there that have money and they're willing to bring it to teams. But that's okay. If the team's clear from the beginning, the problem is when the team, you know, changes their mind and another guy comes with money.
Well, that's the worst thing is when somebody comes along with more money. And then you get nixed out of a job. And I've seen that happen time and again this year. It's really frustrating for me as a fan, if you will, to see that kind of thing happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So as soon as they did that too, I mean, I realized I didn't want to be with that team anymore. Yeah. You know, I mean, guys that are like that, in a way it's good that it happened because, you know, I could see right away how the team was built and what it was about. And it's not about racing or, you know, it's more about the business, which is okay. But it's, you know, it's not a business that they have a sponsor that they're looking to win. It's a business they're looking to make as much as they can. And the result's really not so important to them.
Right. Well, I mean, the bottom line is that the people behind you have to have passion. If that is not there and they don't believe in you, then there's no point in going there.
Exactly. Don't want to be there.
Yeah. Well, I think we agree on everything.
Solved it all, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, and you probably feel better getting that out.
You just need to put a team together, Jim.
You know, the racing team, that'd be badass.
Yeah, definitely got some passion there.
I'm telling you. All right, brother, I will let you go. Thank you so much for taking in a little bit of time, and I will post up a link to your webpage, and best of luck, and go out and kick some ass.
Cool. Thanks a lot. I'm going to click on Daytona, see what they're doing over there.
Yeah, you should. I'll send you the link right now.
Cool. Thanks a lot. Bye.
All right. So, Kenny, thanks a bunch for that very heartfelt chat that we had, and you guys out there in Motopodland have kind of got a little bit of insight as to what happens and how the economy is affecting racing these days. Phil, you're going to be chilling out down there, but I'm assuming it is probably once again hot as hell.
Actually, it has been quite hot, around about 29 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure how that translates either Fahrenheit. My motto is that if you've got to go metric, you've got to go metric every inch of the way. but there's a cool breeze blowing today, so that makes it a bit more pleasant. But I don't think I've ever been to a race meet at Eastern Creek where the weather wasn't unpleasant. But we're tailing off we're actually tailed off somewhere in the early part of autumn here. But we've had a lot of rain here, and it's still very, very humid and sticky. So it's not exactly a pleasant weekend, but the racing is fantastic, and the laid-back, relaxed, comfortable, matey sort of atmosphere at these post-classic meetings makes it worth the cost of admission all by itself.
Are you missing the air-conditioned press room that I managed to set up for you last time?
I certainly am, mate. I tell you, that was wonderful because it was 39, 40 degrees every day at Eastern Creek, and I'd duck out, do an interview, come back, chill out in the press room in the cool with the air conditioner for a while, and then duck out again. And I can tell you, I wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't been able to take refuge in the press room and rehydrate and just cool down again, because it was very, very punishing at the island.
I know they were giving us sandwiches. Sometimes it's not the best affair. There are different venues that will actually serve you some amazing food, but halfway decent sandwiches, at least, I hope.
Yes, the sandwiches were very, very nice, and, you know, unlimited supplies of bottled water as much as you wanted. I do have to tell you, though, Jim, if you'll just bear with me for a minute, I have a little bit of a worry about MotoGP photographers these days and photographers in general. I used to photograph years ago with a pretty basic outfit. And you walk into the press room and you see all these guys sitting at the desk, all with their laptops open, scrolling through all the photographs that they just took. And guess what? They're all the same. I'm really concerned about the lack of creativity that our motorcycle racing photographers are showing. They're all taking cookie-cutter photographs.
And I will agree with you. In fact, I was having a conversation with Andrew Wheeler, who is one of the preeminent MotoGP photographers.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that he does that I absolutely admire, because Phillip Island has a tendency to lend itself to a bunch of guys taking photos in the same spot.
Yep.
And the thing that I, I've been doing this long enough and have had press access to team press photos for long enough. The thing that you see enough guys in corners and you're like, okay, I've seen a guy in that corner. Great. The thing that I appreciate, and to all you photographers out there, budding ones, the things that I look for now is I want to see pictures of people's faces. I want to see the humanity of the racing Yeah. So if there are folks out there that are either getting into it new, or those of you out there that are actually getting paid for it, can we please, please, please have more intimate photos of what the riders are actually going through? I could do just fine with no more photo. Well, maybe not no more photos of somebody going through a corner, but the ones that actually express people's human emotion.
You're preaching to the choir, Jim. Any halfway decent hack with a decent camera and a decent lens and photographer's access now can bang out those photographs forever. It is just so easy to do. And the majority of them are straight heads-up pictures of the bike coming towards you. They don't know how to pan a shot anymore, and they all look the same. Let's have some photos down in the pit. Let's have a photo of a guy who's just come in. His helmet, he's taking his helmet off. He's got sweat running down his brow, and he's looking at his crew chief saying, what the hell is going on here? That's what tells you what MotoGP racing is about.
Yep, and frankly, from MotoGP all the way down to the club level, that is why, as a racer myself, that is the kind of thing that defines it. I'm glad I'm preaching to the choir and I'm singing the exact same tune, and I've said it for years. That is the kind of thing that I think appeals to the true race fan.
Because you see, Jim, they're just technicians. They're not artists. They don't have the creative flair to look at something and say, that would make a really cool photo.
Yeah. Well, don't take it too far, because we will alienate some of our photography friends.
Absolutely. Look, I understand that. I apologize if I've offended anybody, but yeah, I just want to be in my bonnet about that. It just seems a bit odd to me. But for example, I had a friend who came here yesterday and took some photographs of my bike. And he's got this glorious photograph taken from up on the top of the grandstand with Dave sitting on my back and Graham Crosby sitting on the RG500 from the back with their arms folded, just sitting waiting to be told that they can actually take off. And it just sums up the whole thing perfectly. The bike's not even moving, but it tells a story.
Yep. Do me a favor. Describe to me, because I have not delved in enough, and nobody's going to understand when I say, okay, shadow effects. Describe to me how that bike started and how it's come about.
Okay, well, the bike was built by a bunch of mates of mine who were club members of mine in Canberra in 1981, and it was built as an endurance racing bike. They took a wrecked Z1R Kawasaki, braced the frame, fitted a whole lot of custom-made parts, custom-made fiberglass tank and seat, and they took it to Oran Park in March 1981 for this 800-kilometre endurance race. The bike then raced in several other events before it actually was involved in a very huge accident at Bathurst and was written off, basically. The guy who rode it fixed it up and rode it as a road bike until 1988. And in 88, the engine dropped a valve. He pulled it apart with the intention of fixing it, and that's as far as he got. He was heavily involved in the movie industry by that stage, and he was a very busy man. And then in 1995, I got a telephone call from him saying, "Hey, Phil, do you want the Shadowfax Kawasaki?" And I said, "What do you mean, do I want it?" He said, "Well," he said, "I've got to move house," he said, "and the place that I'm going to doesn't have enough garage space." He said, "I really would like the bike to go to someone who appreciates its history." He said, "But if you can't take it, it's going to go to the tip."
Mm.
And I said, "Well, yeah, that's not going to happen."
Right.
So I took it, and it's been living in various sheds of mine up until May last year, when I started recuperating enough from my accident to actually be getting around. And my wife said to me, "You know, you're bored at home all day by yourself when I go to work." She said, "Why don't you go and fix up that old bike out the back?"
And basically you've turned it into what I would easily term as a work of art.
Well, it is. And but the big thing about it is, Jim, is that I have restored it to absolutely original condition.
Right.
It is as it was in 1981, even down to still having 18-inch spoked wire wheels.
It might even be better than it was in 1981 because you had the opportunity to use more modern materials.
Yes, in some respects, although we've used about 90, we figured we were about 95, between 95 and 97% original parts.
Mm-hmm.
Just about everything on the back is original, mm-hmm. Except for the 29mm smoothbore carburetors that Ed Hazel sent us from California.
And slightly more modern tires.
Actually, that's a funny story. You would know, of course, that nobody makes 18-inch slicks anymore.
Right.
But Dave Quinn, who is the guy who did my engine build, Dave Quinn had tucked away in the back of his garage two sets of 18-inch Avon slicks that he bought 10 years ago.
You or whoever riding it is then a brave man because tires don't age well.
Well, I'll tell you what, he took it out yesterday and he gave it a hammering on those slicks yesterday. And he came back and there was no chicken strips left on them, and he said it felt fantastic.
Absolutely cool. Very, very cool.
Now, what I do need to say to you, Jim, just real quickly, if I can, is why we call it the Shadowfax Kawasaki. If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, you'll know the connection straight away. The Shadowfax was the name of Gandalf the Magician's horse.
And it
was bigger and stronger and had more endurance than any other animal in Middle Earth. And the guys who built the bike were all mad Lord of the Rings fans, so they thought endurance bike, we'll call it the Shadowfax Kawasaki.
Okay, so this bike has basically emerged from a bunch of geeks, is what you're telling me.
Oh, absolutely. And the amazing thing is that it started as a community project, and it finished up being one as well.
Nice. It's funny. I've been, talking on and off with Ed since he got back from the classic races, and the boy is still buzzing.
Oh, look, I'm as high as a kite, and I'm even worse this weekend because I've got to see my restored bike finished and running on the track with Brian Crosby.
Yep. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. Did you offer Graham a ride on the thing?
I did, and he said he would love to do that. He said, however, he said I have got this RG 500 Mark I. He said, and I'm devoting my attention to that. He said, if by chance I'm not able to ride it, he said, I would love to ride your bike.
Nice.
And I have photographs of him standing with the bike.
Very, very cool. Well, I look forward to it. You've got a great website. Halfofmylife.com. We'll make sure to include a link to that because you've got some great photos of the bike. I think I need to wrap this up because this is going to be a long show. I do want to we did have AMA Daytona last week. Last weekend.
Bad Lola Miles.
Yeah. We did have
Lola Miles. She's tops.
Yep. Absolutely. And my intent is to get an interview with her. I had sent her a couple of text earlier today trying to get her on, but we're not going to be able to get her on for this week. But she will definitely be on soon. I want to thank everybody out there in Motopod land for taking the time to listen to the show. If you would like to make a donation, please do so. Those of you that have done so, trust me, it has really helped, and it will help even more going forward. We need to get to the races. We need to obviously cover our hosting costs, because as more and more of you listen to the show, it costs us more and more. And we want to make sure that we can continue to bring you this great content and stuff that you've been looking forward to. Phil, I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule down there in Eastern Creek, Australia, or New South. Is it Australia or New South Wales?
New South Wales, Australia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Us folks up here in the Northern Hemisphere, we can't keep track of what's going on down there.
You've got more than enough to take care of without worrying about us.
True. Well, we've got 50 states, and you try doing that. Very, very cool. I am looking forward to seeing what the folks say about this show, and I am looking forward very much so to Qatar. We've also got BSB Racing coming up very soon, and, dude, the season is nearly upon us.
And we have the next round of World Supers coming up soon too, don't we?
We do. We got Imola coming up, once things get that busy, I basically believe that is when Jules and I go into absolutely zero sleep mode.
I understand. Actually, I've got to tell you, there's a young fellow here racing this weekend with an RC45 Honda done up in Castrol team livery like Colin Rhodes at Imola in 2002. I tell you what, it looks so spooky out on the track.
Nice. Well, I hope you had the opportunity to listen to the call that I did with Colin a couple of months back. That thing was brilliant.
Yeah, I did. He's another guy that's he's always worth listening to, because he's game to say things that a lot of other people aren't game to say.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. All right, mate. Listen, I'll let you go. Thanks so much for taking the time, and folks out there, hopefully you enjoyed the show, and we will talk to you next week.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity of being part of it, mate. It's great.
All right. Cheers, brother.
Yeah, at this moment, we did a long run with one set of tyres, which we're quite happy with. We did more than race distance with the tyres, and we did the fastest laps at the end of the tyre life, so we're really happy with the consistency of the tyre with our bike. And really, you know, we got some good testing today. We compared the tyres again that we had in the first Sepang test, the front tyres from Bridgestone, to try and get a good indication of which direction to go. We had a very similar feeling to the first test, so we know what we prefer and what we don't. Then we had, we tried the hard rear tyre. We did some really nice laps with this. The consistency again was very good, and we just tried to update some electronics with the bike, because we struggled a little bit with this in the first part of the day, and we just need to really confirm some things and try and move forward a little bit with the electronics.